The Salem witch trials are among the most cited episodes in American religious history, and among the most misunderstood. Misunderstood, I think, and sadly misrepresented. And critics of Christianity routinely invoke them as proof that religious faith breeds intolerance and superstition. And I have to say there's a kernel of truth in that charge. Superstition did play a role. But a more honest reading of the historical record reveals something far more troubling and way more instructive. A catastrophic breakdown in the judicial system. Understanding what actually happened in Salem requires that we first step back and see the event against the much larger backdrop of the European witch craze. That phrase, witch hunt, well, it's entered our language as a shorthand for a crusade to find something damning in an otherwise innocent victim. What rarely gets mentioned, at least in popular retellings, is that while the New England colonies experienced a brief and contained episode of witch hunting, witch trials had been a fixture of European life for three centuries, from the 15th through the 18th centuries. The European witch craze reached its deadliest peak in the 70 years from 1560 to 1630, decades before anyone in Salem had even heard the word witch whispered as an accusation. Scholars estimate that somewhere north of 100,000 people were tried for witchcraft across Europe between 1450 and 1750, with about half of them being found guilty and executed. And to put those numbers in perspective, Germany alone executed an estimated 26,000 people for witchcraft, and a single day, in 1674 in Sweden, 71 were executed. Even in Swiss Geneva, 500 were burned at the stake. Historian Brian Levac noted that the trials were driven by a toxic convergence of legal systems that permitted torture, theologies that treated witchcraft as a capital crime, and community rivalries that turned neighbors against one another. The most influential document fueling this craze was the Malleus Maleficarum, and it's Latin for the Hammer of Witches. It was published in 1486 by the Dominican inquisitors Heinrich Kramer and Jacob Spanger. It was first printed in the German city of Speyer. The Malleus was reprinted then 26 times over the following two centuries. It became kind of the go-to handbook for witch hunters and inquisitors across Europe. It classified sorcery as a form of heresy, recommended torture to extract confessions, and provided step-by-step legal procedures for prosecution. Now, ironically, when it first appeared, the top theologians of the Inquisition at the University of Cologne, they condemned it as theologically inconsistent and recommending illegal procedures. But that condemnation did almost nothing to slow its circulation. The book was one of the first texts that was mass-produced on the newly invented printing press, and it spread rapidly. It was cited as an authority until 1692. Now here's the critical contrast with Salem that's almost never mentioned in popular accounts. By 1692, the European witch craze was just about spent. The Enlightenment was taking hold across the continent. England had seen relatively few prosecutions compared to the continent, partly because its jury system imposed checks that church courts did not. Salem was not the beginning of something, it was the final tragic flicker that was already burning out. So check out these statistics to keep things in perspective the next time someone brings up the Salem witch trials. In Europe, over 300 years, about 100,000 people were tried, with about 50,000 of them being executed. In New England, before the main event at Salem, there had been only three hangings for witchcraft. Then, in that main event at Salem, over a little more than a year, from 1692 to 93, somewhere between 150 and 200 people were accused, 19 were hanged, one was pressed to death, 5 died in prison. So total deaths, 25. Now, even one death on a charge of witchcraft, that's a miscarriage of justice. But the disproportion between what happened in Salem over a single year and what happened in Europe for three centuries is essential context. And it raises a serious question. Why did Salem happen at all, so late in the story, in a colony whose English homeland had experienced relatively few such trials? Well, let's find out. Salem Village in 1692 was a community under massive stress. A recent smallpox epidemic had left grief in nearly every household. The threat of raids by Native Americans allied with the French kept the frontier in a state of terror, so much so that many Salem residents had fled the violence of the northeastern frontier. The Massachusetts Bay Colony had its royal charter revoked in 1684, and it was still operating under an uncertain one. Many Puritans interpreted all of this as a sign that God's favor was slipping away, that Satan's forces had infiltrated their new Zion. The idealistic Puritan project, the city on the hill that we talked about, it seemed to be crumbling. Now, into that anxious atmosphere walked a new pastor with a talent for, well, let's just say he had a talent for dividing people. Reverend Samuel Parris arrived in Salem Village in 1689 and quickly earned a reputation for a rigid theology and greed. He shrewdly negotiated his contract to include ownership of the parsonage. It was an unusual demand that angered many in his congregation. Salem was divided into two camps, those that supported the new pastor and, of course, those that opposed him. Now, as was common in many New England households of Pastor Parris's status, there was a Caribbean slave named Tituba. Now, details are sketchy. Her origins appear to have been in African descent, then to the Caribbean, and then to New England. Tituba entertained the young girls of the household with stories of the occult and had indulged their curiosity about fortune-telling. When 9-year-old Elizabeth, the pastor's daughter, and her 11-year-old cousin, Abigail Williams, began exhibiting strange behavior in January of 1692, the village doctor, William Griggs, was called. The girls screamed uncontrollably. They threw things. They contorted their bodies. They had raging fits. Dr. Griggs's diagnosis was that they had been bewitched. Now, there's a case to be made, as the Encyclopedia Britannica puts it, that the girls' behavior was nothing more than a performance designed to get out of punishment for being caught gazing into a crystal ball in their attempt to read their fortunes. But when the attention their behavior generated proved rewarding, other adolescent girls began to exhibit similar symptoms. The social contagion spread quickly. Wait, hold on. Whoever heard of a bizarre fad among young teenage girls desperate for attention? That just never happens, except all the time. Under pressure from civil magistrates, the girls named 3 women as the source of their afflictions. The accused were your classic soft targets, people already on the margins of respectable Puritan society. Sarah Good, she was a homeless beggar, desperately poor, and not the kind of person who could defend herself in a courtroom. She was accused. Sarah Osborne was an elderly woman who'd not attended church regularly, so already suspicious by Puritan standards. She was another one that was accused. And of course, Tituba, who was a slave and was of course most vulnerable of all. She made a fatal decision under interrogation. She confessed. And more than that, she gave the magistrates exactly what they wanted, describing elaborate visions of black dogs, red cats, yellow birds, and a tall man with white hair who asked her to sign his book. Now, those animals were already fixed in popular parlance as sinister agents in league with the devil who offered people special power if they would sign away their souls. Tituba claimed that there were other witches in Salem working to destroy the Puritan community. Now, with that confession, the seeds of paranoia were planted. The accusations would not stop at just 3 women. Salem Village was already fractured by a long-running feud between the Putnams and the Porters over land, over grazing rights, and over church privileges. 12-year-old Ann Putnam became one of the most active accusers, and some of those she named were conveniently on the wrong side of her family's feud. Community grievances found a new, legally sanctioned outlet. Anyone who dared to question the girl's testimony quickly found themselves under suspicion, a dynamic that, of course, silenced dissent. Pastor Parris, rather than exercising pastoral discernment to cool the hysteria, used his pulpit to fan it, preaching that anyone in Salem, even anyone in the church, might be in league with Satan. His sermons contributed directly to the atmosphere of terror. When little Dorothy Good, the 4-year-old daughter of the accused Sarah Good, was arrested and interrogated, her timid, confused answers were construed by the magistrates as a kind of confession. It was clear that the legal system had gone off the rails. Dorothy spent months chained in a dungeon. Her father later testified that she emerged so traumatized that she had, quote, little or no reason to govern herself, unquote. And she never recovered. As the accusations multiplied and the jails filled, eventually housing somewhere between 150 and 200 of the accused, the newly appointed governor, William Phipps, established a special court of oyer and terminer, a legal term meaning to hear and to determine. Now, the court was presided over by Chief Justice William Stoughton, who resisted any questioning of how he proceeded. Stoughton's operating assumption was that God would never permit the devil to use an innocent person's shape, their form, to torment others. So, in his thinking, it followed that if the accusing girls said they saw someone's specter tormenting them, that someone must have consented to be an agent of the devil, in league with Satan, on a mission to destroy God's work in New England. It was a logical trap with no escape. The central piece of evidence driving convictions was what was called spectral evidence. Testimony from the afflicted girls that they had seen ghostly or spirit-like images of the accused tormenting them. This type of testimony had been used in English witchcraft trials for over a century, but its use at Salem was aggressive and it was impossible to refute. The court also employed folk tests of doubtful legitimacy, including, well, reciting the Lord's Prayer. The theory was a witch could not recite it correctly. When Minister George Burroughs, a former pastor of Salem Village, who'd been accused and convicted on the basis of spectral evidence, when he recited the Lord's Prayer perfectly from the gallows, the crowd was shaken. McCotton Mather, who was present at the execution, reminded the crowd that the devil himself could appear as an angel of light. And the hanging proceeded. Oh boy. You know, first to be brought to full trial was Bridget Bishop, a twice-widowed tavern keeper, whose immoral lifestyle and habit of wearing black clothing made her an easy target. She'd been suspect of being a witch for years. She was found guilty and hanged at what came to be called Gallows Hill there in Salem. Five more women followed a month later, including Rebecca Nurse, a 71-year-old grandmother so well regarded in the community that a petition of 39 neighbors was submitted on her behalf. The jury initially returned a not guilty verdict. Oh, but Chief Justice Stoughton sent them back to deliberate again. They changed their verdict. Nurse was hanged. Then a month after that, another five were hanged, and then eight. Now, some of those arrested confessed to practicing witchcraft, and they named others, but in the hope that cooperation would spare them. Scholars now believe these confessions were extracted under duress and with the implicit promise of leniency, a promise rarely kept, but which served as a survival strategy in the short term. None of those who confessed were executed. Everyone who was hanged maintained their innocence to the end. Now, the most haunting case is that of Giles Corey. He was an 80-year-old farmer, the husband of Martha Corey, who was also accused. And Giles, for whatever reason, testified against his wife early in the proceedings, before the scale of the injustice became clear. When he himself was arrested, he refused to enter any plea at all. His legal reasoning was pretty shrewd. Without a plea, there could be no trial. Without a trial, his estate could not be seized and stripped from his heirs. Now, the court responded with a form of torture in which the subject is placed on the ground and heavy stones are piled on his chest, one by one, until he enters a plea or dies. Over two agonizing days, Giles Corey was slowly crushed. His only recorded words when asked to enter a plea were reportedly, "More weight." He died without saying another word. It remains the only death by pressing in American colonial history. The prosecutors and judges in the Salem trials were not reckless. They operated within a theological and legal framework that most educated people in the 17th century accepted. The reasoning went like this. Witchcraft was a capital crime under both English law and the laws of God. Exodus 22 verse 18 says, "You shall not permit a sorceress to live." Well, Satan is real, active, and capable of recruiting human agents. The colony certainly seemed to be under some kind of spiritual attack, evidenced by the afflictions of the young girls. The court's duty was to protect the community. Spectral evidence was admissible under existing English common law. And the court held that since God would never allow the devil to impersonate an innocent person, the spectral appearances were de facto proof of guilt. The confessions of some of the accused, well, they seemed to confirm the existence of a conspiracy. And within that framework, the prosecutions felt not like persecution, but like, well, public protection. The opposition came from several directions, and it was more substantial than is usually remembered. Cotton Mather, who's been caricaturized in popular memory as a fire-breathing zealot urging the court to hang more witches, in reality spent the early months of 1692 urging caution. Before the first formal execution, he wrote to one of the judges, quote, "I must humbly beg you that you do not lay more stress upon pure specter testimony than it will bear," unquote. He and 11 other Boston area ministers co-authored a document called The Return of Several Ministers, which criticized the court's reliance on spectral evidence and recommended more cautious proceedings. It was ignored. Increase Mather's contribution was more decisive. In early October of 1692, he completed a work titled Cases of Conscience Concerning Evil Spirits. It was a carefully argued theological treatise delivered to a gathering of Boston ministers. His central contention was that the devil could indeed take the shape of an innocent person. He cited the biblical witch of Endor and the story of Job. So, spectral evidence was an unreliable basis for a capital conviction. He wrote, quote, "It were better that 10 suspected witches should escape than that one innocent person should be condemned," unquote. That was a direct challenge to Stoughton's foundational assumption. Increase Mather also rejected the folk tests, water ordeals, the Lord's Prayer test, as pagan in origin and unworthy of a Christian court. He argued that accusations of witchcraft should require the same standard of evidence as any other capital crime. Corroboration by at least two witnesses, not the testimony of a single afflicted girl. Now, the civic leader, Thomas Brattle, he wrote a scathing open letter that ridiculed the proceedings, calling the court's methods superstitious and the judge's reasoning incoherent. Samuel Willard, minister of Boston's Third Church, had been an early supporter of the trials, but grew alarmed as respected members of the community were suddenly being accused. Even Governor Phipps himself, returning from military operations on the frontier, was shocked to find the colony in an uproar, especially after his own wife was whispered about as a possible suspect. So he dissolved the court of Oyer and Terminer in late October and replaced it with a superior court that refused to admit spectral evidence. Now, two things brought the trials to an end. First, the theological and legal arguments against spectral evidence gave a growing public discomfort an intellectually respectable foundation. Second, the accusations had just it stretched too far. It's one thing to accuse social misfits and oddballs. It was another entirely when the accusers began pointing at people everyone knew to be models of virtue and upright living. At that point, even those who'd believed the girls began to wonder whether something else was going on. Several of the accusers reportedly began to test the limits of their power, and the community started to push back. The last trials ended in April of 1693, and all remaining defendants were found not guilty. Governor Phipps issued a general pardon in May of 1693, and those still imprisoned were released. The reckoning came slowly. 5 years after the trials, the Massachusetts General Court declared a public day of fasting and prayer in atonement. On that day, one of the trial judges stood publicly in his pew while his minister read a statement of confession and apology that he had written, accepting personal responsibility for the, quote, blame and shame, unquote, of the proceedings. 12 of the trial jurors also issued a public apology. In 1711, the Massachusetts General Court passed a resolution restoring the civil rights of the condemned and authorizing damages to be paid to the surviving victims and their families. The compensation amounted to £578 paid to the families of 24 victims. 7 of the condemned were not included and remained convicted of witchcraft. The last of them, Elizabeth Johnson, she wasn't officially exonerated until July of, you ready? 2022. And the Salem trials also left a permanent mark on American jurisprudence. The haphazard evidentiary standards, the denial of the right to cross-examine their accusers, contributed directly to later legal reforms, including the right to legal representation, the right to cross-examine witnesses, and most fundamentally, the presumption of innocence until guilt is proven. In a strange way, the injustice of Salem helped build the foundations of a fairer, a juster system. What should we take away from all of this? Well, Salem is often weaponized as an argument against Christianity, but the historical record tells a more complicated story. The initial hysteria was certainly shaped by Puritan theology and by a genuine, if misguided, fear of the demonic. Pastor Parris used his pulpit to fuel that fear rather than to check it. But the voices that ultimately brought the crisis to an end were also pastoral voices. Increase Mather's careful theology, Cotton Mather's early and largely forgotten caution, Samuel Willard's growing alarm. Listen, it was not secular enlightenment rationalism that stopped the Salem trials. It was a return to better theology and a recovery of the biblical standard that the innocent must not be condemned. The deeper lesson of Salem is not that religion is dangerous, but that any community, religious or secular, that allows fear to override due process will produce injustice. The 20th century gave us secular versions of exactly the same dynamic in the Soviet show trials, the McCarthy hearings, the Maoist struggle sessions. The mechanism is always the same. Accusation becomes proof. The accused cannot defend themselves, and anyone who questions the process becomes a suspect. Salem is a mirror, and what it reflects isn't Christian so much as, well, human.